nation's water system to a huge nationwide, but within Indiana, certainly huge water utility. And to find out more about that, let's turn to Anthony Swinger. He works in the Office of Utility Consumer Counselor in Indianapolis. And Anthony, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be on, Chris. Thank you.
A little history first. How did the city of Lake Station, as far as you all know, got into this point that they needed to sell their water utility plant, in particular the filtration plant and all the components that go to it, and how Indiana American Water Company got involved in all this?
Well, I can kind of speak to it from a broader standpoint, Chris. The general policies that the State House has been promoting that have been coming out of the General Assembly in the last few years have supported greater regionalization among water resources throughout the state. And one of the new laws that's passed makes it easier for a large investor-owned utility, a water utility specifically, mm-hmm. to buy the assets of a small municipal water utility. That in and of itself is not a bad thing. When you talk about acquisitions and when you talk about mergers, there can be a lot of benefits there. The customers of the smaller community benefit from the technical expertise and resources of being managed by the larger company. The customers of the larger company benefit from bigger economies of scale. You have a bigger customer base over which you can spread the costs. So the acquisitions themselves are not the concern. The concern in this particular case is the request by the utility to include a portion of the purchase that goes toward an asset that's not going to be used by the customers of Indiana American Water. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, Chris, it's about a $20 million price tag. And what we recommended specifically before the Utility Regulatory Commission was that between $7 and $8 million of that $20 million price tag be disallowed. Mm-hmm. Specifically because that was the portion to pay for a treatment plant that won't be necessary with, you know, Indiana American serving its Northwest Indiana customers with Lake Michigan water. The used and useful standard is one of those basic benchmarks in utility regulation that's been around a long time. It's been on the books in Indiana for decades. And it's really nationwide one of the key principles of utility regulation. If ratepayers are going to pay for a certain asset, whether it's a water treatment plant or a power plant or a new set of natural gas distribution lines, the utility has to demonstrate that the customers or the customer base overall will use those assets and that they will be useful to the company in providing water or gas or electricity to the customers. And in this particular case, the treatment plant in Lake Station did not meet that standard in our view. And as a result, we have an appeal pending before the Indiana Court of Appeals. This was a case that the IURC decided on a 3-2 vote. Split decisions out of the Regulatory Commission are very rare. So it's a pretty unique case in a lot of ways, and we've made our arguments to the Indiana Court of Appeals. Lake Station and Indiana American have until the 28th to file their brief in the case, and then we have until mid-February to file our reply with the court. So that's where things stand at this point.
So it looks like that once all the papers are filed, all the appeals are filed, I guess, in this, it's going to be sometime maybe in March, I suppose, or maybe even later before the Court of Appeals hands down a decision?
Yeah, I never speculate on how long the commission or a court may take to rule on something or what exactly the ruling might be. But again, you're looking at the filings in the case not being complete until mid-February. So there will be some time before a decision's made and before we get an opinion from the court. I do want to mention one thing, and that's really to give credit where it's due. Mm-hmm. There are five formal parties in this proceeding. We had five formal parties in the case before the commission, and there are still five formal parties in the Court of Appeals case. Obviously, two of those parties are Indiana American Water and the City of Lake Station. Another party, of course, is the OUCC representing consumer interests. But this is also a case where the city of Crown Point and the town of Schererville intervened. Both of those municipalities are wholesale customers of Indiana American Water. They appealed in the case, and well, they intervened in the case. And actually, the brief that we have filed with the Court of Appeals is a joint brief of the OUCC as well as Crown Point and Schererville. So I want to give credit where it's due.
Does it seem that in that case here, we're talking about Crown Point and Schererville joining in on the dispute, that they're concerned, of course, because, as you say, they're wholesale customers of Indiana American, which, of course, means they're buying all the water for their communities from the utility, that they think that they figure they're not going to get any benefit to be sure that even if there is a sale here, that maybe the this piece of, I hesitate to call it a piece of equipment, but it's basically a water filtration plant that's supposed to be part of this deal that's not going to be used, at least that's what the utility company says is not going to be used. Or maybe if it has to be in the case of an emergency or something like that, that these other communities that are on the water system are not going to get any benefit out of it either, huh?
Yeah, and I'm always very careful about not speaking on behalf of other parties, and I certainly would not want to put any, you know, words in the mouths of Crown Point or Schererville.
Yeah.
But certainly, being wholesale customers, they have a strong interest, because anytime you talk about rates changing or going up for a utility, they'll go up for the retail customers, of course, but they also go up for the wholesale customers as well. And therefore, you do have a strong interest there.
Are we finding it, from your experience working with other utilities for the OUCC and seeing all the paperwork that they file here, when you have situations like this, when you've got a big water utility that turns out that there are communities that are affected one way or the other, I keep thinking about issues even come up with the city of Hammond, for example. City of Hammond pulls its water directly out of Lake Michigan, but it is offering it up to other communities around it. The towns around Hammond, in many cases, are now over in Illinois, are getting benefit of this water coming out from Lake Michigan through Hammond. So everybody's all concerned about how much they have to pay for either their wholesale or retail for their water.
Yeah, and I think another way we can look at this is from a statewide angle. As you know, Chris, Indiana American Water is the biggest investor-owned water utility in Indiana. Mm-hmm. It has customers literally as far north as Lake Michigan and literally as far south as the Ohio River. In the last two or three years, Indiana American has received approval from the IURC to buy four municipal water utilities around the state. In addition to Lake Station, you have two communities in far southern Indiana near Louisville, and more recently they've had the acquisition of the Sheridan Water and Wastewater Utilities in central Indiana. Sheridan is a small community kind of on the outer fringe of the Indianapolis suburbs. When the case went through the commission with Indiana American purchasing Sheridan, we didn't see any red flags. In fact, if there were any yellow flags, I don't remember them or they weren't there. But the bottom line in Sheridan was we reached a settlement agreement on that acquisition, and that was approved by the commission. There were no appeals, and I believe that sale closed here very recently.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to look at each of these cases, each of these acquisitions, on a case-by-case basis. You have to look at the facts that are unique to them. And keep in mind that obviously we have the appeal going with Lake Station, but the Sheridan case is an example of where an acquisition, you know, can be done very amicably. Again, the issue here is not the purchase of the utility or the acquisitions or the mergers. The issue here is what cost will be borne by the utility's customers.
Yeah, that's
and should they have to pay for an asset that they're not going to use.
Right. Well, also, speaking of utilities customers, let's bring up another topic that's related with Indiana American Water Company. They are looking for a big rate increase because they want to do some major infrastructure work around the state of Indiana, but here in Northwest Indiana, too. Anthony, what seems to be the status from the OUCC's point on how that request is coming along?
The rate case with Indiana American Water is a completely separate docket from the Lake Station acquisition. So
right.
I just want to draw a very clear line distinction distinguishing that.
Yeah, we're just talking about the same utility, but two different cases entirely, yes.
Exactly. As far as the rate case goes, the case is still pending before the Regulatory Commission. The utility has asked for a $38.8 million a year increase. That's an increase of about 17% over its current revenues. The OUCC filed testimony in late December recommending denial of that increase. In fact, our analysis based on the information we have right now shows that about a 7% decrease would be appropriate, or about $16 million. Again, that's based on the information and the evidence that we have right now. And we've made that recommendation to the commission. There are a lot of steps remaining in the rate case. Indiana American has the chance to file rebuttal testimony later this month. There'll be an evidentiary hearing in Indianapolis starting in mid-February, and then there'll be additional filings by the parties after that hearing. So we're probably looking into the late spring, maybe early summer, before there's a final decision in that case. But in the rate case, right now, we're recommending denial of the request. And that's based on about a three-month review that was done by our attorneys, our accountants, our economists, and our engineers.
Well, Anthony, thank you very much for not only the update here on the rate case that Indiana American's putting forth here that everybody's considering, which will have an impact on everybody that has water service through the Indiana American Water Company, but also, too, about the situation with the City of Lake Station's attempt to sell its water plant to the utility, too. Thanks for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you, Chris.
Anthony Swinger is a spokesperson for the Indiana Office of Utility Consumer Counselor. A new research center will analyze policies and practices that are related to social factors in Indiana. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan tells us that the center would focus on how disparity affects the lives of Hoosiers.
The new Center for Research on Inclusion and Social Policy, or CRISP, will conduct research on how social issues like income, education, and housing impact quality of life in Indiana. Brianka Merritt is the director. She says these issues often influence Indiana's poor health outcomes.
How do we help or better understand the issues of those of us who have the most struggles and the greatest difficulties in overcoming hurdles in order to make our outcomes better as a state?
The research could help policymakers, nonprofits, and community leaders better understand how their decisions impact services. The center is based at IUPUI in Indianapolis. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Our next stories come to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I probably, over the years, have had a couple incidents where someone used a racist term in class because there were no people of color in that classroom, and so they felt safe in doing it. A lot of times kids will test you to see if you're going to say something. And then I always wonder, it's like having a kid come in to your last class of the day wearing some t-shirt with some offensive, crude remark on it, realizing that no one challenged him all day long and sending him to the bathroom to turn the shirt inside out because you can't do that. You know, I think in those times where I've had maybe two or three times ever in my teaching career where someone said something that was, you know, derogatory and inappropriate, and I just corrected them. How would you feel if you were alone somewhere? You were the only white person, and then people did that to you. I mean, doesn't that golden rule thing apply? Don't you really want people to treat you the way you would treat them? Why would you say something so crude or offensive or racist or whatever else it is? That's one thing that, you know, 40 years as an educator has taught me, that, you know, you don't let anything go unchallenged when it comes to something like that. You just say, you know, that's inappropriate, or don't talk like that, but you never, ever look the other way. Then, if they want to argue with you, you can take it to the next level. Usually, a good scolding solves the problem. At least they know where you stand. When you challenge that one person, there might be someone else in there who may be thinking about doing something, and then suddenly they may give up on that idea, and then maybe eventually you win them over. But changing people and their prejudice is not easy.
A good neighbor is one who may not be related to you, but who cares about your well-being, who cares about what your needs are, who is willing to meet those needs, and at the same time, because you've developed a relationship, you are willing to meet that neighbor's needs. As a rule, my mother's parents lived in town, and she had brothers and sisters who lived in town. But more often than not, I wouldn't go over my grandparents' house if my parents went out. I would go to my neighbors and would spend the night at their homes. You know, it was just like being at my own home. So a neighbor is also an individual who is willing to contribute their part to keeping the community vibrant, to keeping the community friendly, and making sure that the community is safe. One of the things that I think is important is to get back to that sense of neighborhood, sense of community through block clubs, through Neighborhood Watch, because the good thing about Neighborhood Watch is if you start watching, then you'll know who the bad actors are, because they're not going to come to the block club meeting. And then so all eyes can be focused on them. When I think about Gary today and the perception that people have of Gary, a lot of it is based on individual or isolated media accounts. And so I know that people have a position or a thought about crime in Gary, about blight or abandonment in Gary. There are still some of those neighborhoods that exist today. Certainly my own neighborhood, even though my mother no longer lives in the house that I grew up in, her sister does. And she still has the relationship. We have a neighbor who's almost 90 years old who still tries to go out and shovel her sidewalk, and she has to chase him in the house. And that's because he's been doing it for over 60 years. And that's just what a neighbor does in his estimation, even though, you know, he's as old as he is.
You can find more regional stories online at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Indiana University Northwest is offering an opportunity for students in the health-related professions to learn more about topics like ethics, disability, and anthropology. Indiana University Northwest faculty members Crystal Shannon and Jonathan Briggs talk about the new Medical Humanities minor program on the Gary campus. And Professor Shannon begins the conversation, and Professor Briggs will join along.
Especially when it comes in the play of healthcare, we want to ensure that healthcare providers remember that a patient's experience comes with them to the clinical setting. Once they enter the healthcare environment, be it a physician's office, an outpatient clinic, the inpatient setting, or a hospital environment, they bring all of those experiences and expectations with them. And it helps to guide them throughout their experience with us, but it also may help to impact how they experience healthcare with the providers. One thing that we hope that our students will gain from continuing their exploration into the medical humanities is the understanding of that patient's background and their story about their own lived experiences and how it's influenced how they seek healthcare.
Who thought up the idea of creating this medical humanities minor?
I developed it, Chris, kind of out of my own experiences of moving into a new field of research, which was I'm working up on a project right now about the history of autism. When I started to engage new scholars, I began to realize that a number of them were coming from other fields, philosophy, anthropology, sociology, but that there was a kind of shared experience among them, which was that much of their research engaged with the practice of medicine, and that there was a value in this engagement. And this was known as medical humanities, and it was happening in a number of institutions across the country. And so in talking with these kind of new colleagues of mine, I began to realize, well, this would have a value as well at my institution. And so I looked within the institution for resources to develop this, found some colleagues whose work could be fit into this idea. And, you know, lo and behold, here we are a few years later, and, you know, we're launching the ship here as well.
What type of topics can this particular minor cover when you put that into the big interdisciplinary program that's called a medical humanities minor?
Well, being a participant myself, it involves history, but we also offer courses on anthropology, on literature, in communications, and then as well as philosophy, particularly with ethics in medicine, which is something that really was also a kernel in this, in that there was already this ethical component required for the sort of medical practices within the institution. So I was able to kind of germinate out of that to develop this program. And where I'm hoping to go with it as well is to do things as well like creative aspects. So in a number of conferences that I've been involved in with the medical humanities, one of the things that I've seen that I think would be very beneficial is that medical doctors also come to these and present their works, things like films or painting, poetry, where they're looking at the patient experience using, say, the fine arts. So I'm hoping to develop that as well here and finding allies within, say, the fine arts or within creative writing that we could integrate into this program as well. So how I'm envisioning it is kind of open-ended where, you know, we could allow students in this to explore through a number of different ways.
Now, we know, Professor Briggs, that your new online course called The History of Disability is one of the five courses that's going to be in the curriculum that IU Northwest has set up for this new medical humanities minors this fall. What, besides your particular work that you were doing on the history of autism in France, what else led you to come up with the curriculum for this particular course?
Well, I mean, certainly part of it is rooted in my own experiences. My son is on the autism spectrum, so I began to get kind of involved with a number of organizations that work with not only autistic children, but more importantly, autistic adults. And so I began to think about, well, my own assumptions, I suppose you could say, about disability and about the rights of the disabled. And I realized, oh, well, there is a whole corpus of works on this, and I think that this is an important thing to kind of communicate to students, especially students who have a tendency to work with these kinds of populations. So it led me to think about, well, not just kind of mental disability, but also physical disability, and what are the similarities and differences between them. And so I thought this would be worthwhile in teaching a whole course. I ran a pilot of it about 2 years ago and got some really great feedback from the students in this pilot, and it helped me to build the course as it is now, in which we start with around the 18th century and the Enlightenment and begin to think about how Western society has framed disability in various ways, and how even the notion of disability has changed since then, where something that might be disabling at one point, one of the case studies I used about glaucoma in the 18th century, now this is a kind of treatable condition, and so no longer is glaucoma necessarily considered to be blindness.
Have you had a chance to talk with some students that you've experienced in some of your other courses or before then as to whether they're looking forward to maybe signing up for some of these courses?
I actually have. I've talked to them very frequently about them as they're looking for electives and they're thinking about minors, for them to strongly consider this as an adjunctive minor to a profession that really promotes the encouragement and the connection to patient care. And I do believe that by participation in it, it will just give them a wealth of experience, a wealth of foundational background that they will be able to take with them into the clinical care environment.
There's been a lot of discussion in recent months and even in the last few years about trying to help build a strong and educatable workforce to be able to take on the jobs of the future here in Indiana. Some of the work is being left, of course, to public schools to try to make revisions in the state's graduation requirements. And that is how the Indiana State Board of Education has gotten involved here, to find a way to help come up with employability skills. And in turn, there's been some changes that are being proposed, some recommendations being made on graduation pathways. That's what the State Board of Education is working on. And we have with us Northwest Indiana's representative on the State Board of Education, Tony Walker. Tony, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good afternoon, Chris.
Thank you, and good afternoon to you. Will you kind of give us a little history lesson here on the concerns that have been voiced over the years, or at least certainly before the State Board of Education, about coming up with a workforce that is able to tackle the jobs and the tasks of the future, and how that kind of relates back to how the high schools in Indiana should be dealing with it?
And this was sort of an interesting history, because typically education policy bubbles up to the state level from the field, from the schools and school districts. But this one, I believe, really came more from industry and came from the employers in the state talking to the elected officials about their troubles filling jobs in the state of Indiana, and about the skills of the workforce in Indiana that were showing some concern to a lot of major companies throughout the state that looked to hire workers. And as a result of that, the governor and the State Board of Education and the Indiana General Assembly also came to the conclusion that we needed to change the expectation of high schools in Indiana as to what type of education they're providing kids, and not totally overhaul it and throw out the baby with the bathwater, but right, to make sure that when kids walk across that stage and the diploma is put in their hand, that they can actually do something. Right now, this previously and still right now, the system is sort of slanted toward higher education. But as we know, not all kids are going to go to college, and not all kids are going to even get two-year degrees. So what we as a state board try to do with graduation pathways is make the high schools responsible for assuring that every student that graduates has some skill set that will allow them to either go on to college or go into the workforce.
When did the State Board of Education get involved in this conversation? Obviously, it's a conversation that started a long time ago in maybe the individual school districts around the state, or in the state employment agencies and the like, that decided this is the people that we have to work with, and these are the jobs that have to be filled, but the education skills are not there as they should be. When was the discussion first brought up, as best as you can tell?
Well, really, you know, education policy is really controlled by the governor of the state. So the conversation's been going on for many, many years under many different governors. But it was Governor Holcomb, when he came in, that really said, we're going to address this issue and make it a priority. And within his first year, the state board actually changed the policy and the graduation requirements to put graduation pathways out front.
Tell us how the system is set up right now, with recommendations that have been made and ones that have been offered that I guess the State Board of Education will consider in more detail later if need be. How the graduation pathway seems to be shaped up right now?
Well, we've had a tremendous outpouring of support and participation from educators all throughout the state in putting together what we just adopted as a guidance document to school districts to actually implement graduation pathways. I mean, there was a phenomenal number of educators and school districts participating in the development of that doctrine. And where we're at now is trying to encourage school districts to not wait until, you know, for the two-year period or so when it has to be implemented, and try to set systems up now and start forming partnerships with local industry, partnerships with local nonprofits to provide the work-based learning and service-based learning experiences for kids immediately. It's being phased in. So right now, for instance, this graduating class still had to pass our examination in order to get their diploma. Otherwise, they'd have to get a waiver. So we're getting rid of that one-size-fits-all kind of testing out of high school requirement. And so you won't have that test now that you have to pass to graduate, at least the statewide test. And instead, we're looking now for more hardcore evidence that you have developed not only work experience, but service-based experience and project-based learning experiences, which hopefully will help students develop not only hard skill sets, but soft skill sets, that would make them have a smoother transition either into the workforce or into college.
If you will, take us down the options here in a little more detail here. You mentioned starting out about the work-based learning. Tell us more about that and what you're hoping with the employability skills that's put these benchmarks into place, how state school systems as well as the employers can take advantage of that.
And that's going to be part of the challenge of the implementation, particularly in some of our smaller districts in more rural areas. I don't think we'll have as tough a time of implementation here, but sort of what the expectation is that school districts will start forming partnerships with local industry, whether it's U.S. Steel or whatever is in your area, particular area, to develop some opportunities for students to come in and perform internships, for them to get together, say, with United Way, have a partnership with United Way, where maybe they go and help do some service projects in their area, where all of that now is credited towards the graduation requirements for public service experiences that the student has, workplace learning experiences that the student has. And then also we're encouraging the school districts within the classroom to move to more of a project-based learning experience and move away from the model slowly but surely of just sitting students in the classroom and talking to them for 55 minutes or 60-minute period and then sending them home with homework, and looking to have it to be more of a hands-on, interdisciplinary experience while they're in the classroom facilitated by the teacher.
Now, I recall when I was in high school, I had opportunities, and some of my fellow students had the opportunities to take advantage of being able to get your classwork done a little early and then take off as long as you were going to a job of some type. Is that something that's being emphasized again to encourage the fact that school districts make room for students to be able to have a job? It might be a benefit to them to what they can learn to be able to find a career in the future?
Yeah, and I think you've just touched upon what's going to be one of the probably biggest challenges in implementing it, is that we're going to have to relook at how schools do their scheduling, whether or not they use block scheduling or whatever kind of scheduling format to make room for students to be in and out of the building throughout the course of the day. So I think in many ways it's going to go back to what you just explained your experience was, but even probably more of that.
Do you think that even with the changes that are being proposed here to go to opportunities where you've got pathway options like work-based learning, as we've just kind of referred to here, where you have a chance to not only take your classes in school, but also go work in the afternoons, we'll say, at some job. And then service-based learning, as you mentioned, being involved in a civic or a volunteer experiences along with your classroom training. And then of course, the project-based learning, which is what you're hoping to go to. Will this change anything dramatically, in your opinion, based on what the current pathway is? That is, and we know that it's kind of a veering off a bit, to go into a pathway where a graduate will in turn get his high or her high school diploma or certificate of some kind, and that will kind of aim them perhaps toward higher education, but hopefully first be ready for a job.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a dramatic change because you're going to have more and more students graduating, number one, with college credits, because part of this also is really trying to focus on dual credit programs, which I think are really going to pick up as a result of this as well. So I think you'll have more and more kids, particularly in their junior or senior years, maybe spending part of the day at their high school and then part of the day at Ivy Tech or Indiana University Northwest or Purdue Northwest. So you're going to have a lot more of that going on. But you're also going to have kids that are now not only graduating with a diploma, but are graduating with industry certifications, which will allow them to go and get much more higher paying jobs within the state of Indiana.
And do you think this is also a given opportunity, maybe people hadn't thought of before, to be involved in apprenticeships for some of the trades that still offer apprenticeships?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I'm working on right now with our state board. Because currently we don't have a career and technical education concentrator in plumbing and pipe fitting.
Right.
So I'm trying to establish now in the state of Indiana a pathway for plumbing and pipe fitting. because I have a lot of friends that are plumbers and pipe fitters, and you know what? They're always in demand.
Well, that's what you would think.
The world, apparently.
Now, we're noticing that there's always a demand for plumbers and pipe fitters. There's always a demand for well experienced carpenters and joiners and some of the other trades, construction trades in particular. We want to see more houses go up, more office buildings go up, and get them filled. But somebody has to build those.
Absolutely, and that's one of the first meetings I'm looking forward to have is with Northwest Indiana Building Trades Council. As soon as we can get the foundation set and the state approval for having a plumbing and pipe fitting pathway, to see if we can come up with some program that is sort of a precursor to entering into the union trades program up here.
We're talking with Tony Walker, who is Northwest Indiana's representative on the Indiana State Board of Education. The Board of Education is dealing with graduation pathways options that are being made available and being discussed these days. We've talked about the way to help make young people more employable in the workforce as they finish up their high school and maybe some college experience to get a certificate of some type. What kind of changes, if any, are planned in the options for those who are maybe actually going to continue on and head on to college? Any changes in the benchmarks that they're facing, the SATs, the ACTs, the other exams they might have to face?
There are changes that I think are going to really help our graduating college-bound seniors. One, for instance, we're looking at changing our 10th grade standardized test to the actual SAT. And hopefully we'll be able to work it out with the General Assembly for the state to actually cover the cost for students to take that SAT. The other thing, or SAT, ACT, or one of those tests, it hasn't been determined which one yet.
Uh-huh.
But I'm just saying the ones that people know.
I'm sure that there are probably a lot of details that have yet to be worked out, that a lot of this has had some good options that have been offered, but in the discussion, the recommendations that have been made, but you have to come down to actually how to practice this.
Yeah, and the other thing is we're really looking to have strong partnerships with our local state universities. I mean, Ivy Tech's been a great partner, as has Purdue, Northwest, and IUN. So I think there will be more linkages between the local school districts and those universities to assist kids to get more college credits while still in high school. And there's one school, 21st Century Charter School in Gary, that actually pays the fees for their students to take those courses. I don't know how many other school districts actually do that, but that's a possibility. But in every case, those fees are subsidized, and they're cheaper to accrue. It's cheaper to accrue those college credits on a high school dual credit track than it is if you were actually enrolled in the college. So you get the added benefit of, I think you're going to have a lot more high schoolers graduating with a year and maybe some of them even 2 years of college credit under their belt that have been either significantly subsidized or paid for them.
Tony, you're here in Northwest Indiana, so you get to see an area that is still, even though it's reduced in size, still a pretty much industrial area. How do you get to cope and some of these questions that come up and in turn interact, I suppose, with your colleagues on the State Board of Education in some of the other counties elsewhere in Indiana, say in central Indiana, where we find more technology-based jobs and related things, certainly involving higher education. How do you get to be able to see how these pathways are going to be able to, be accomplished in some of these other counties of the state?
Well, one of the things, we have great accountability because we are relying heavily and working on this with Indiana's Department of Workforce Development. That's one of the things I think Governor Hochul has done that's been unique to his tenure, is pretty much bringing together the workforce development community and the education community totally. We're pretty much working hand in hand in everything. So we have constant access to their data. For instance, you know, they tell us that by 2020, 65% of all Hoosier jobs are going to require some type of training beyond high school. So in planning out all of these processes, as well as in assisting school districts to plan out their pathways, we're all working very closely with workforce development and the data they have. So we will be able to see the economic impact as far as jobs, employability, and all of that directly through our interaction with workforce development.
Now, do you and your colleagues on the State Board of Education feel confident that the pathway requirements are going to be able to be ready for the graduating class of 2023 as the goal is?
Oh, I'm confident they're going to be ready before then. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm really happy that we did with the pathways is we provided local school districts a lot of flexibility in terms of developing their own locally created pathways. I made a joke at one of our meetings that, hey, maybe Carmel will come up with the career professional tennis pathway.
But well, that's possible.
Up here, I'll say maybe Munster can come up with the professional tennis pathway. But we've given a lot of flexibility for school districts to basically develop this around the resources they have in their communities and the interests of their students. And we have already begun approving locally created pathways. And so I think from what we've been hearing from the field and seeing at our meetings, the school districts are taking this very seriously and getting ahead of it.
Tony Walker, thank you very much for spending time with us to explain what has been discussed in much detail. Hope to have you back again soon. Tony Walker is a Northwest Indiana representative from the State Board of Education. Corporations that give political contributions not only are likely to get a federal contract out of those contributions, but the contracts may be very, very advantageous to the firm. And that is according to a new study put out by Ball State University. And our next guest here on the program is going to tell us more about that. Reza Houston is a Ball State University finance professor, and he has worked with some researchers in a couple other universities around the country on what is being called a sweetheart index. And Reza Houston is with us today. Thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Tell us a little bit about what the term sweetheart index is all about, and how did you and your colleagues from University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, and Florida Atlantic University had to come up with?
The sweetheart index really refers to this idea of a sweetheart contract, where the contract terms are really very lucrative to the firm that receives the contract. So my colleagues and I actually had this idea to create a sweetheart index to measure the quality of government contracts being received by government contractors. And we wanted to look at who actually receives these sweetheart contracts, these contracts that are, well, more lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we did was we looked at the relationship between contributions made by firm-affiliated PACs to candidates for federal office and the quality of future contracts that those firms receive. And what we find is this really positive relationship between the PAC contributions made by these firm-affiliated PACs and the quality of the sweetheart index, or the quality of the contracts that's being received.
Mm-hmm.
And the sweetheart index is really made up of four different characteristics. It ranges from 0 to 4, depending on which of these characteristics the individual contract exhibits. So whether it's a no-bid contract, whether it's a cost-plus versus fixed-fee contract, whether it's a long-term contract, and whether or not there's certain cost or pricing data required at the time of contract signing. So certain contracts exhibit all of these characteristics, whereas certain contracts exhibit none of them. So we actually identify, a couple of fairly significant relationships. Our overall result is that, yes, there is a positive relationship between PAC contributions and the sweetheart index, but we also find that each of these individual characteristics of the sweetheart index, in particular, no-bid contracts or sole-source contracts, and cost-plus contracts, we find a very positive relationship between PAC contributions of firms to candidates for public office and the likelihood that the contracts that they're receiving are no-bid and cost-plus. And obviously, there's some potential endogeneity here, since a lot of these firms that are receiving these large government contracts are firms that operate in industries like the aviation industry or some other industry that's very tightly intertwined with the federal government. And so therefore they're very likely making large PAC contributions. And so we actually had to run a number of endogeneity tests to control for this, mm-hmm. This relationship. And so we did a couple of different things. The first thing we did was look at what happens when a firm increases its PAC contributions to federal government employees. And what we found was that firms that increase their PAC contributions actually see an increase in the quality of the sweetheart, or in the sweetheart index of their government contracts over the next year or 2 years or even 3 years, although it diminishes after that. Next, we looked at what happens when a firm makes a contribution to a candidate for public office who then becomes the chair of a very powerful committee in the Senate or the House. So, for example, let's say, well, name a company that is a government contractor. Maybe I shouldn't. But let's say a company makes a contribution to a current senator who then, after the election, becomes the new chair of the Appropriations Committee.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we're finding is that those firms that make those contributions and then have the candidates that they've contributed to become the chair of a very powerful committee like the Appropriations Committee or the House, the Ways and Means Committee, those firms see the most significant increase in their sweetheart index of their various contracts. And then finally, what we did was we looked at the results of close elections and how firms that made contributions to candidates who were not quite who we weren't sure were going to win their re-election bid or any election bid, what happened as a result of those PAC contributions. And so it's really what we have there is an exogenous shock where after the election, that candidate wins office, and we can look at, well, really what happens with a free hand, so to speak. And what we're finding in that test is that firms that make campaign contributions to candidates who win very close elections, they actually also see a significant increase in their quality of the contracts that they receive in the future.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned at the start of our conversation here that you and your colleagues in Colorado and in Florida had a chance to look over a number of contracts by various companies across the country, mainly dealing, as you say, in federal contracts. And you referred to, like, the aviation industry. Did you also have a chance to look at some information from, like, shipbuilding companies that might in turn be beneficial if they get the right kind of help on Capitol Hill that gets to contracts with the Navy for building ships or airplanes or something like that, or either any other types of procurement contractors like that?
Oh, absolutely. So what we have is a database of more or less all large government contracts provided by it's actually part of the federal procurement data system.
Mm-hmm.
And we matched contracts in that file to, firms that are publicly traded in the United States. And so we have this massive database of several million government contracts. Of course, the ones that actually exhibit these four variables that we can use to calculate the sweetheart index are the larger ones, contracts in excess of about 750,000. But these contracts are given out to firms in a variety of industries. It's not just aviation. It's not just shipbuilding. It could be pharmaceuticals even.
All right. Yeah.
We can look at contracts in just about every, given out by just about every agency in the government.
Yeah, for example, you're talking about pharmaceuticals. You're talking about companies that might possibly be wanting to get contracts with HHS or the Veterans Administration, especially for VA hospitals and clinics and things like that, and get yourself involved in that and in turn make some money and in turn some influence, I'm sure, at those particular areas. When you take a look at all this information together and the contracts, the importance of these people that have influence on the contracts, whether it's awarding them or, as you say, being members of appropriations committees and the like here, and how this all links together with political action campaigns that are out there, the PACs. And you talk about this political connectedness that seems to branch out even beyond making some kind of influence as a lobbyist. And, like, it goes into, I guess, even in hiring as well, too, does it not?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly it does. We actually, one of our variables in one of our later tests, and it's something I've used in some other papers, is a variable that indicates whether or not the firm has hired an individual who is a former politician or regulator to their board or management team. And so what we find is, in some cases, a positive relationship between the prior experience of these individuals or the hiring of these individuals and the quality of a firm's government contracts, although that really wasn't the focus of our paper.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that as we approach the midterm elections, and of course now with all of the atmosphere being as acrimonious as it is on Capitol Hill and in Washington, D.C., that the data that you all have come up with in putting this the sweetheart deal piece together, so to speak, is even more important than maybe ever before?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we're really just beginning to scratch the surface, and now that, well, given the current nature of politics, I think our work is probably going to be a little more important than it has been for the last several years.
We've been talking with Ball State University finance professor Reza Houston, who, along with colleagues working in research at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs and at Florida Atlantic University, which is in northern Florida, have worked together and put out what they're referring to as a sweetheart index. And by the way, if you'd like to find out more about this index, it's going to be published in an upcoming issue of a report which is called the Financial Review. It's a publication put out by the Eastern Finance Association, and I'm sure that if this gets enough airplay, so to speak, and reading in the print media, that I'm sure that they'll either have to put more issues out or they're going to have to make sure that it's available on their website, too, I would imagine. We'll see what happens to come out of this, I suppose. And thank you very much, Reza, for being with us to talk about this. And thanks for you and your colleagues in Colorado and Florida working on this research to find out more about the link between contracts that are offered by federal governments and how political contributions play a very big role in this in one way or the other. It may be more behind the scenes, but it sometimes, in particular this time of year, is more important. Thank you very much for spending time to talk with us about this.
Thanks again, Chris.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.